Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for being here tonight. This is Kim Justice. Apparently, we've changed our intros a little bit. Pardon me, and I didn't know it. So I'd like to thank our sponsor, Gordon Johnson at tbilaw.com. If you have any litigation issues related to your traumatic brain injury, you want to be sure to check him out. Again, tbilaw.com. Also want to let you know that we are on, pardon me, Brain Injury Radio. Got a frog. 7 nights a week, same time, same number, 10 different hosts, all bringing a unique perspective to the table, and all shows after they are live are immediately archived for on-demand listening. They are all recorded, so keep that in mind when we encourage you to call in with your questions or comments. The number here is 424-243-9540. Tonight, I'm going to be having an interview with a guest, and so I'll be taking questions after we've had time for the interview. I think we just had a couple other housekeeping items to take care of, and then I will bring Ian on. The other thing, several of you have heard me mention that it took me 17 years and writing a book of my own until I met my first other survivor. There wasn't any kind of support group or an instruction manual that they gave me when they released me from the hospital. I looked normal and talked normal, and so the assumption all the way around is that I was normal. I knew that wasn't the case, but my family had been through a horrific experience from their own perspective, as well as I had, and I think we all wanted me to be who I was before, so there was a lot of self-imposed denial. One of the reasons that I do this show is so nobody ever has to go through the same situation that I did, and that's to go through recovery in isolation. Completely polarized. That's why I think it's great Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, as well as being able to be accessed at any other time through the on-demand. And we're excited about the new peer-to-peer support line. You can check out the website at the number 4peer11.org. Ultimately, that's going to be a 24/7 peer-to-peer hotline where one survivor slash thriver can talk to another, someone who's maybe walked a little ways in the same moccasins. Right now, we have about 12 hours, I think, covered each day, and we're looking for more volunteers. It would only be volunteering 4 hours a month of your time to answer the telephone. You do go through some training first where they tell you what we do and what we don't do. But if you're interested in giving back or having an additional or renewed sense of purpose, I encourage you to check out 4peer11.org and maybe volunteer for the hotline. We're also looking for some other backup hosts and co-hosts to run the studio. So if you're interested in that, please get a hold of any of the Blog Talk Radio hosts. And DJ in the chat room is telling me there's another training meeting this week for the peer support line. So if you think this is something you're interested in, do go to that website and sign up, and you could maybe get started with training as soon as Friday. So thanks for that information. Okay, I think that's all of the housekeeping. Some of you saw on my Facebook page, I just got back from my sweet little Nana's 93rd birthday party. You heard me talking a few weeks ago when both my dad and my Nana were in different hospitals in the city, and both had some pretty serious things going on, and I talked a little bit about that last week, this week, or a couple of weeks ago, but this week I just want to say that I'm very grateful my Nana was here for her 93rd birthday and that we were able to share it with her. Okay. Without further ado, I owe my guest a huge apology. I've messed up a couple of things with him, and we're going to talk about it when he comes on. But my guest tonight is Ian Powell, to some, McCollum, author of From Grave to Cradle to Now, the Healthcare Professional Edition. The book is a father's account of his family's journey with a traumatically brain-injured son who they were told would die imminently. Written by a healthcare neophyte with the assistance of healthcare professionals, the book addresses separately and together both families and professionals. I've typed in the chat room the website to take a look for more information, but it's www.marrette.cc/hcpro.html. And I will give you that information again. It's posted in the program notes. It's posted in the chat. And we will continue to talk about it. But now I am very happy to welcome Ian. Ian, are you there?
Well, I am, Kim. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure
Thank
to be with
you very much. Now, I apologize for the name of your book. In the first set of program notes, I said From Cradle to Grave to Now. It's really From Grave to Cradle to Now. Can you tell me, aside from my mistake, which I apologize for and is now corrected in the show notes, tell me a little bit about that title?
Well, it's a common mistake because you so frequently hear from cradle to grave. It's such part of our day-to-day discourse. So when the title occurred to me, it occurred to me simply because we were in that process of recovery, you know, from the doctors telling us that my son was going to die imminently. You know, basically dying was just a formality at that point to his recovery, but he was first in a very deep coma, and then he was recovering bit by bit. And so in a sense, you are, as a patient, in a cradle. You're being cared for by family, healthcare professionals, and so on, and you're as helpless as a baby. And the now is obviously a constantly changing now. It certainly changes more rapidly in the period immediately following the crisis, if you're fortunate that your loved one is a survivor, then that now changes over the years, because as we know, brain injuries are subject to long, slow recoveries, and it may take as much as, say, 8 years, for example, just to get your energy back. And
right.
Some of that functionality that you're used to before may not come back. It may not be there, but you may develop through neuroplasticity and the workarounds that you train yourself to do with the help of professionals and your own determination, you may create new sets of strengths that you didn't previously have. And so that now is constantly changing. And so that's the nature of it. We're on a journey. We're continually on a journey and so on. And the patient's on the journey, the survivor's on the journey, but the family's on the journey as well.
Right. So tell me a little. I've had on a lot of survivors, only a couple of caregivers. I will tell the audience that that Ian's son is going to be my guest next week, Andrew, and so we'll get to hear a little perspective, which will be interesting, both from a survivor and a family member. So we won't give away his story, obviously. We're going to talk about yours, but where were you? Did you get a phone call saying your son had been in an accident? Tell me the circumstances from your perspective of how this journey started for you, your family.
Well, on a sort of a Saturday midday in 12:10, the phone rang, but I didn't hear it because I was, you know, I was happened to be vacuuming in the kitchen at the time. And so my wife realized there was a message on the phone, picked it up, listened to the message, handed the phone to me and said, "It's the police. Andrew's been injured. I'm getting ready to leave." And that started it. And at that point, the message, and then I called the sergeant at the scene, and he explained the details. He was found wandering near railway tracks and had lost a lot of blood. But he had walked with them some, 500 or 600 feet to the emergency vehicles, had spelled his name, had told them what his name was and gave them a few bits of information, but from that point on was non-communicative. They got him to a hospital, and he was being assessed at that point. So we drove. It took us nearly an hour to get to the hospital, and from that point on, you know, really the journey began. Initially, we thought, well, he talked. He walked. We actually went into the emergency room and by accident saw him there. We shouldn't have been in there. And his injuries were basically from his cheekbones on up. So that didn't quite fit with the idea of, you know, injury around a railway track and a possible, you know, impact from a train or anything of that kind.
Right.
And then they said we had to send him to another hospital because his injuries, when they did the brain scans, proved to be so severe that they couldn't deal with them there. They didn't have the expertise.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of through the rest of the day, and about 9-10 hours later, that's when the doctor told us he was about to die. And really, that's when it sunk in, the seriousness of it.
I'm assuming, because I learned from someone here that it's called a level one trauma hospital is what somebody in that kind of shape needs to go to, but the people out in the field aren't necessarily trained in that, and there is a fella that we can talk about later who's trying to get a protocol out amongst emergency help people so they kind of know where to take it. But when the doctor told you that your son was imminently going to die, and you said after 9 hours, was that after he had made it to that second hospital, or are we still at the first hospital at this point?
No, we went to the second hospital, and they then told us he would be sort of in surgery for 2 to 4 hours, but it was actually nearly 7 hours when we got this word. And at that time, you know, there were a number of specifics about his injury, but the most important was that they had to remove half his skull to allow his brain to swell, which it did to about 3 times the size over the next 12 hours. And, so it was, you know, it was very obvious that it was quite severe, and it was understandable that the first hospital couldn't really tell, nor could the police tell, just how severe it was, because most of the injuries were significant external injuries, but more significant internal injuries.
Wow. Okay, so they then said he wasn't going to make it. They did go through the surgery, though.
Yeah, and just to reassure your listeners, that was 5 years ago. And if you were to meet him today, you wouldn't know that there was anything amiss. And that's the result of at least 3 miracles and a lot of very good medical care. So it's that was very severe at that time, but we had no way of knowing, of course, none of us do when we start these journeys, what
right.
the outcome is going to be. And we still
that's
don't,
right.
because that's why the now was so flexible, you know, in the title, because, you know, we're mm-hmm. continuing to move into that future.
It is interesting. A lot of us, a lot of our families have been told amongst our host and our audience by the medical professionals that we weren't going to make it. And there's a lot of miracles here. So when you said at least three miracles, that's what I write about in my book too, are some absolute miracles. And just about all of the hosts that are on Brain Injury Radio, as well as a lot of the survivors that are listening, and the caregivers, have been party to miracles, because each one of their families was told that they weren't going to make it. And now there's several of us, like Andrew, that you wouldn't know to look at us, that we had been in that situation or that we had a brain injury. So,
yeah, and when you talk to him, and I think you have spoken to him, you
yeah.
really can't tell much from his speech. I mean, he's insightful, he's funny, he's warm,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you can't really tell, although there still are lingering effects and so on. But, you know, one of the things we talk about, the miracles, and it's, I think, often the case that family members feeling in this alien environment and in this tremendous shock that they experience, are completely helpless, and some of them, you know, sort of abdicate any kind of responsibility for trying to help their loved one because they don't know what to do and they don't want to make it worse. And what we discovered, and almost by instinct, we just decided to get involved in bringing him back. But you know, the doctors did tell us, and because that's what they foresaw. But in a sense, it kind of did us a favor. You know,
yes.
in a sense, you sort of, at that point, that is the worst. That's the absolute worst. So anything you get back from that point on is good.
Right.
And so instead of concentrating, at least for me, instead of concentrating on trying to prevent him from dying, I had to accept the fact that effectively he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I concentrated on, what do I now have to do to bring him back? And I write about it in the book. We got into something which I later called blood harmony. And that's where family members have an extremely strong technique that medical professionals do not have. And yet families too frequently don't go to this technique because they're unaware of it. And so what I'm trying to do in part through the book is to make medical professionals aware of it and to apply it. You know, and I must say that some medical professionals that were there, nurses and primarily the nurses, but doctors too, said, well, look, you know, there's nothing to lose. You know, go for it. And that basically blood harmony is you play the kind of nature and nurture cards that we've got. You know, when it comes, the term some of your listeners may recognize comes from the music, where you get music groups of families that have grown up playing instruments, grown up singing.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the womb, some of the family members have heard the music. And when they're born and as they develop, they then begin to participate, and the group adjusts to the harmonies that are created. And so you get these wonderful, rich harmonies that professionals can't experience. You know, they just can't make it, no matter how good they are, how talented they are, how trained they are. They just cannot, you know, get an equivalent kind of sound. It's very unique to those groups. So the same kind of thing exists between a parent and a child, and it will exist between spouses too, although it's a different quality. But it exists certainly between parents and child, because there is the DNA, you know, there's what we're born with. There's all of those little connections. Then there's what we learn from each other as we evolve our lives together. And so you kind of resonate with that. So very simple things that you can do. Touch is really big. Constantly stroking the patient, because each family member has a unique way of touching and of stroking. Rubbing the soles of the feet. Kissing is really important. It sounds frivolous. It sounds pointless. But kissing allows the patient and the family member to engage chemoreceptors. You know, that is the nose, the smell, the scent that is unique to each of us, but mm-hmm. which another family member will recognize. And I go through this exercise when I'm talking to nursing schools. I get them to close their eyes and imagine a particular kiss with or from somebody close to them, you know, a grandmother, an aunt, a parent, a child. And just remember that, and they will. They inevitably do remember that. And that is really powerful, and that reaches into comas. You know, all of that stuff, that blood harmony stuff, reaches into comas. And it's so important because in the coma, the patient is completely lost. They don't know what's up, down, sideways. I make the argument that it's a bit like a warehouse that's been hit by an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's on the floor.
Right.
Everywhere, just scattered. The patient's job in the coma is to try and put each of the items back on the appropriate shelf. The problem is the patient has no idea what any of those items are, has no idea what shelves are, doesn't know what a warehouse is, doesn't know what's up, down, sideways, front, back, you know, future, present, past, memory, dream, imagination. They're totally lost. So blood harmony is the way that we as family members reach into that coma to orient that patient towards life. Because it's, you know, if you're in that space and you're in pain, I think it's natural for the human body to try and find that place of least pain and most comfort. And unfortunately, that may be death, and that may be the choice they make.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a couple of us, myself included, who have said that. We had near-death experiences and would have stayed if the choice would have been ours to make. And mm-hmm. it was from that extreme pain and from the feeling we got on the other side that made us want to stay. So it's intriguing because when you're talking about the things you are, it gives me a realization different than the way I had considered my own. And that's when you talk about the family keeping the spirit back or pulling the spirit back to the human plane to stay mm-hmm. here instead of moving. I never thought of that as being an integrative experience, but very interesting. Continue.
One of the other things which, you know, and your audiences are primarily survivors, and some caregivers, and I assume some professionals too. But there have been cases of people who read the book and have recommended it to others, families that are in crisis. People in crisis don't have time to read books, but what people can do, their friends can do, and families that are not the close family but are related can read it and get stuff out of it and then pass that along anecdotally. And one of the situations where that occurred, the daughter, who was in her early 20s, was deeply in a coma, and they were told about blood harmony, and they immediately got to work with the blood harmony, you know, reading stories, telling stories, playing music to the patient, massaging them for sure, kissing them and all of that. And I got an email from this woman telling me that this was happening, that their friends were doing that with their loved one. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I hope to hear soon that she is coming around. And the next day I got an email saying she died. And I was quite shocked and depressed by that, because I felt in some way that I had failed. And it took me a day before I could sort of email back and say, I'm so sorry, I didn't, you know. And she emailed back right away, and she said, no, don't be sorry. It was a grand farewell.
That's what I was going to say when you said it, is that you helped someone cross over. I could see it working both ways, you know, holding the spirit here on this plane or making the transition harmonious.
Yes, and I think it also gives relief to the family to know that they have done the best that they can possibly do.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And
so,
I had never thought of that.
Well, I did only because I recently had a friend pass away, and you know, we were there doing some of the things that you were talking about. And I mean, this lady was fine. She was perfectly good health and not exactly a brain injury, but one day she just, boom, was blind. She went into the first a little blurry vision, and she went into the doctor and went completely blind within 3 days. They told her she had a brain tumor, and she was gone in a couple of weeks. It was that quick, you know. And we were up there with her at the hospice, and at the point we were rubbing some scented oil on her and rubbing her arms and her hands, and one of the other girls with me was rubbing her feet, and we were talking to her and recounting some stories. She said, and she had been, you know, she was not aware anymore. She was deep into the morphine, but she suddenly opened her eyes and said, and this lady was an older gal, but a real rascal, a fun kind of gal, and she said, "He's just so handsome in his waistcoat." And this was out of a coma, you know, and we kind of stopped, you know, our rubbing for a moment and looked, because we were all a little taken back that her eyes snapped open, but she was looking at something. She saw it, you know, and I said, "Marty, is that somebody that you know?" And she said, "Oh, yes." And she died, you know, she died a few hours later. And, you know, that's why when you said that, I could picture you feeling the way you felt from the vantage point and the experience that you had. But from the one that I had with this friend and another friend that I write about in my book, where the same type of thing happened, it's really just giving the spirit the support to move on, you know, the harmony, the grace to be able to move on, almost like passing it, you know, from a person from your arms to God's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And the, you know, but in the early stages where the spirit is trying to make up its mind, and it needs a lot of help, and that's what families can do. They can provide that, and it's an important part of the process of rescuing and returning that person to life, if that's the choice they make, and ultimately I think it is their choice. And that's you know, absolutely wonderful. But if they must go, then at least both parties on each side of that equation can be satisfied that they've done their best, and can go on into life feeling that, with that kind of peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really, really important. But he, you know, he came through it, and, you know, as you probably had in your case and heard from others too, there's lots of weird stuff happens in the hospital as they're recovering and they come out of the critical period. Some really funny stuff. I mean, it's kind of black humor, a lot of it, and I talk about it as kind of a, you know, your own personal serialized graphic novel, you know.
Yeah.
And it's well worth collecting those anecdotes and telling them back to the patient when they come around enough to receive them, because they can be quite funny. And it's part of the process of discharging stress as well, that kind of humor.
Well, you got to have one of the things I think we'd all agree on here is that you got to have your sense of humor. You know, if you didn't find some humor in it somewhere, it would really just be, it might stay black, you know, and be too overwhelming. So it really helps to be able to find that sense of humor. So how long was it that Andrew was, I mean, so now you've been at the hospital, the surgery has gone on, the doctors said he's probably not going to make it. How long was your wait until he came to and said his first words?
He was in a coma and then in an induced coma for, I think it was about, for nearly 10 days. And he was, my wife made a call to the hospital, as she did every morning before we went in, just at the shift change, and mm-hmm. talked to the nurse, and the nurse had asked him, you know, had seen some signs of movement and recovery, and asked and spoke to him and said, "What's your name?" And he told her his name. And that was the first indication that anybody had that he would ever speak again, because, you know, up to that point, while he was still in the coma, with what the doctors had been telling us, we had no idea whether he would ever be aware of his environment, you know,
right.
ever again, never mind speaking or seeing or, you know, any of those things, feeding himself or that sort of stuff. So that was a big, that was a powerful statement of his return.
Yeah.
You know, and he was, you know, and he was in hospital, including rehabilitation hospital, for 111 days.
And wow. So what kind of rehab, well, we'll talk more. I know the audience is always interested in rehab, but again, some new people have come into the chat room and probably onto the line. So I will tell you folks that this is Ian, and are we going to go by Phillips or McCollum?
Powell? Ian Powell.
Powell.
Probably the easiest because it's the book. It's what's on the book. Well, the book was written under that pseudonym. Powell is actually my middle name, but it was written under that pseudonym for practical reasons at the time, necessary reasons, as it turned out. But
okay.
It's the easiest.
Okay, we won't even use one. Ian, my guest tonight, his son, Andrew, is going to be on the show next week. So we have a unique opportunity to hear the caregiver point of view this week and some great information that Ian came upon in his journey that he's sharing with medical professionals as well as other caregivers, and then hear the perspective of the survivor next week when we talk to Andrew. So,
and Andrew's now 37. I think your audience might be interested in, you know, where he is in his life.
And you said that's been how many years ago?
It was 5 years ago. He was 32 when he was injured.
Okay. All right. Well, good. We'll be anxious to hear his story, and we'll ask him a little more about the rehab that he had next week. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to stick to the caregiver side and some of the things in Ian's book, because one of the things that I've heard a lot being a host from the audience and from the other hosts is what I said at the beginning of the show, and that's that it seems like there's some deep gaps, you know, between hospital and going back to your life. They, you know, especially if you look
mm-hmm.
normal and you talk normal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's one thing
mm-hmm.
if there's something obvious that they can treat, but at the point that you look okay, they send you back out into the universe. But again, this part is from a survivor point of view. I'm not processing the same as I was because
mm-hmm.
of the experience I just had. I'm not the same person
mm-hmm.
I was, you know. And so there's a lot of things that are different. Did you notice, I've never even asked my parents this, so I'll ask you, were the differences in Andrew very noticeable to you immediately, and then as time has gone on the last 5 years?
Well, certainly immediately, going through the, you know, through the early stages and recovery, you know, it was frontal lobe and left temporal lobe injuries, and so there were certain executive skills, inhibition, and so on, are compromised at that mm-hmm. point. And, you know, for the most part, he is, you know, functions perfectly well, but there are still some lingering effects. And to go back to, you know, to put that in the context of your comment about what others have told you in your own experience, is that one of the things that I've come to realize, well, first, 6 weeks into the experience, Andrew had a visit from a colleague and friend of his, and they were talking, and I overheard the conversation, and Andrew said to his friend, I'm not better, I'm not worse, I'm just different.
Good attitude early on.
Absolutely. Amazing. I mean, it was really amazing. And that had a tremendous impact on me. And from that, it's changed my life as well. But from experiencing Andrew and Andrew's recovery and from getting to know other survivors as well in the various institutional settings and elsewhere since then, it has made me come up with a couple of sort of conclusions. One is that I no longer can use the term normal because I believe that it is not only wrong, it's a bad description. It's just mm-hmm. a piece of shorthand we use because we're lazy. It's convenient, but it's also dangerous because, you know, when you think of the world at large, none of us are normal.
Right.
We're
That's what
different.
I've always thought. I think people compare their their insides with other people's outsides too often.
That's a great way of putting it, you know, but we're all different and we ought to be celebrating those differences, you know. Obviously, there's things, attributes that we have in common and attitudes and so on. But
sure.
That's, you know, that's, I just can't do it. It wasn't an intellectual decision on my part. I suddenly realized that I didn't relate to the term anymore. I just didn't,
right.
You know, I see everybody, not just survivors. I see everybody as unique and different. I mean, it's like this experience has pulled a veil from my eyes, and I see the world now in greater color and richer and more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk to medical professionals, I talk to, you know, hospitals and nurses and so on, I suggest to them that, yes, rehabilitation has to be done with patients and for patients. And yes, there are certain normative benchmarks that we measure performance and progress by. And those are some of them related to the species, you know, us people, and some of them are related to the survivor himself. But
mm-hmm.
I think too often they set expectations that are false, and I think that families fall into that too, and so do the patients. We get too anxious about making rapid progress, and the rapid progress we're trying to make is to a place that no longer exists.
Right.
And it sets up all kinds of stresses,
mm-hmm.
and it sets up relationship problems, and it's damaging. I think that we need, and in their process of rehabilitation, too often they focus on the disability or the deficit. They don't focus on the strengths. And I think
exactly.
that if they had greater focus on strengths, if we did, as patients, survivors, caregivers, as well as the medical profession, that focus on strengths, it makes people's morale much better, gives them much more positive attitude. They have greater energy to put into, you know, their rehabilitation, you know, their future.
Right.
And so those are the kind of conclusions and evolution of my thinking that came out of that comment that Andrew made to his friend.
Wow. Well, that was very insightful of him at such an early point, you know, in his experience. I don't know if I could have articulated that clearly at the moment that he did. I would have known that something was different, but, you know, for him to be able to say not better, not worse, different, and describe it in a neutral way like that instead of one of the extremes, you know, was very insightful and a gift, you know, for him to be able to march toward his recovery with that attitude. He already had a positive spin. A lot of people start out with, you know, the stigma attached to being quote unquote disabled and believe the press, you know, what they hear from others, what they might feel about themselves. And that becomes a preponderance of the battle in the beginning is not only the physical deficits and working through that, but also emotionally being able to let go of the old me and acknowledge and accept there's going to have to be a new me and grow comfortably into that skin. The way I've always said it is, I didn't get a second chance at life just for the sake of life. It's to create a life worth living. And, you know, what that is different to different people, I'm sure, you know, their interpretation of doing that. But for him to be able to go into the process with such great insight, I think is really a cool deal.
Yeah,
it takes
absolutely.
A lot of us a long time to get there. I'm going to have to talk to Andrew about that next week because, you know, some of us spent years getting to that point. So, you know, that was really a gift for him that he had it so early and that it made such a profound effect on you. When did you decide to write your book? Did you see that there was... You said you spent a lot of time around the rehab center and you spent time meeting other survivors, so you were able to take in this information that you had probably never been exposed to before, right? Suddenly you're in the middle of these new realizations.
Yeah, I mean, you go through this process, and I liken it to you go through all these stressors, and you immediately – load up on your back something I call the sack of dread. And it's the stresses, it's the adrenaline toxins, it's all that stuff that's in your, that you're carrying around, and you're afraid you're going to explode at any minute and have a complete meltdown. And so you keep trying to push that away. You try to avoid rupturing it, and you take all kind of steps to avoid rupturing it, you know, just so that you can get by and you can function, and that you can function on behalf of the patient as you need to do, and your family, the rest of your family as well. And yet at the same time, you're sort of observing, and part of my skill set that I guess that I brought to this experience was, you know, I've been an executive, I've been a management consultant, I've done a lot of writing, you know, and a lot of analysis of organizations, and I've had some experience with medicine in the sense that I was did some work for a friend of mine who had set up a cancer research foundation and a treatment center. So by no means was I any kind of medical expert, but I had enough there that I could. There was a part of me that was remaining a bit objective. So that was one thing. So I was watching and I was learning and I was trying to keep it together. Another son of mine, the day after the injury, set up a Facebook site. And so each day, the core family, and that was particularly my wife and my other two sons, and I would sort of shape what was happening that day, you know, try to understand it and boil it down to something succinct that we could stick up on the, you know, on the Facebook site.
Right.
So we had a record. We posted about twice a day. And so we had that history that went on for months and months and months. So that was the first thing. We did have a record, and I started keeping journal notes, which are things that I didn't put in the Facebook postings, but I, you know, since I made the notes anyway, I just sort of hung on to them. Then I was asked to give a talk to a community group about 6 months after this happened. And Lord knows how I managed to make it through that talk. But the process of preparing it helped me pull together a lot of that information, and it also was kind of cathartic as well.
I'm sure.
And then Andrew's psychotherapist asked me to write an article that was going to go in a publication that she issues, and Andrew wrote a piece for it as well, and I had that in my book too. And so that sort of got that down. And then a professor of nursing saw the piece that I had written, and she said, you know, if you added a bunch to that, it would be ideal for teaching nurses about life on the other side of the bed, you know, from a father's perspective, because we never get to read a male perspective of a, you know, caregiver perspective as opposed to a medical professional or a survivor.
Right.
And so I said, well, I don't know medicine. How could I have any legitimacy in such a book? You know, because I wasn't aware what I had. You know, I knew I had this material, but I didn't know whether it was useful or not. So I said, I'll do it, but only if you'll work with me to do it. And she did. She agreed. So then she made initial overtures to nursing schools and to hospitals where she had contacts. And they said, yeah, we'll buy it. We'll use it. So that's how the book came about.
That's really amazing, because that, again, that's one of the things, you know, professionals not being aware that causes a lot of the survivors grief later on. So it's, I find it encouraging that someone in the medical, and also a miracle that you guys, you had the experience that you had and happened to run into her as a willing professional to corroborate this thing, was really kind of a miracle in itself, you know, that you guys were able to hook up. And I'm encouraged that she showed the interest in your side of the bed.
Yeah, and I have been gratified to find in nurses and in hospitals that there is an awareness there. That this is needed, and that they don't have much opportunity and many resources to be able to introduce that. And they're finding, some of them are telling me that, you know, with the increased amount of technology, medical technology that's now being used to diagnose and to treat, that a lot of the people being attracted to nursing are people that are more interested in the technology and are not particularly you know, good at the bedside manner and that sort of thing. You know, empathy is something that they've got to try and draw out of these people to make sure that that's there when they go in and talk to,
right?
You know, patients and so on. You know, so I'm both a little shocked that has become an issue in nursing, but gratified that you know, the nursing schools and hospitals are now trying to change that, to fix it.
Yeah, because some of them don't. You know, the surgeon, a couple of us likened it to a car going through the body shop. You know, to the surgeon, you're the vehicle passing through, and they have a technical skill set. They're able to practice to, you know, fix the broken engine, but then the car is going, what the hell just happened? And,
yeah,
and you're kind of bounced out on the street when you look right, you know, and checked back to get your sutures pulled out. And then, you know, you don't really know where to go. Like I said, my deal happened in 95. And when I started on this radio show in the last number of months, I decided, you know, my surgeon had been a visiting surgeon, and it's been a long time, and this husband wasn't here when that happened. My parents wouldn't be able to take care of everything. We were kind of the same age, you know, me and Andrew. At the time, we were having our incidents, and our parents were young enough to take care of everything. Not so for me now. So I found the go-to man who could, you know, do a craniotomy in town, and made an appointment with him and asked him if I could park my file at his office. I didn't want anything from him, but if I needed help, I wanted to know if he'd help me. And then I said, do you know if there's any kind of support group or someplace I could connect, you know, with people that had gone through the same thing? I really feel like I fell through a medical crack. And he said, well, I wouldn't know anything about that. You'd have to check with the gals at the front desk. And I'm like, really? The ones that make the appointments? Anyway, they weren't aware of anything like that. And so I was like Eeyore walking out, you know, the difference between 1995 and 2012 at the time, and seeing that it hadn't progressed any further. You know, I just thought there wasn't ever going to be anybody that was going to understand, you know. And then I, like I say, I stumble into writing my own book and into a brain injury community, and everybody understands, and I'm not half the nutcase I thought I was. And we all got bad memories and some emotional swings, and there seem to be some common deficits. You spoke earlier about, you know, the first there's the initial recovery, and then it can take, you know, 5-8 years, maybe never, to be able to regulate that fatigue issue. A lot of different types of residuals that people have, but it seems like a lot of us share some, like that memory thing. It seems to be a bugaboo for most of us.
Yeah, I think that one of the positive signs that's happening, you know, the whole area of neuroplasticity and the study of that, and the recognition that it happens, and you know, over the past 15 years has been great. And I think that the research that I have seen that's ongoing now and will change over time, will evolve with some of the new diagnostic tools that are quite portable, is that we're now going to find that as patients recover and develop workarounds, you know, for that part of the brain that was permanently damaged, that they are going to be building strengths that they never had before and that others may not have either. And identifying those strengths, and then if you look at the whole issue of the rehabilitation therapies, if they can identify these strengths within the individual, they can then build therapy and rehabilitation around those strengths. So it's not just a question of fixing and putting back to the old order whatever it was that was broken in the injury. It's a matter of developing those strengths. And I think that people are going to find themselves a lot more productive, a lot happier, and a lot more accepting of the new them.
Yes. Absolutely. Once you understand that that's what you have to do, that's why, you know, the theme of my show, Recovery Now, is about you finally come to the point, you know, that you're into this new me, and you're not going to, you finally let go, I guess, of the old me and want to grow into that new me.
Yeah, and I think also that whether you got a brain injury or not, every day you do dumb things. And I think that one of the difficulties that survivors have is that the dumb thing, and they're both being hard on themselves because we all do dumb things, but they chalk it up to the brain injury instead of just accepting it as, that's me, you know, and I just did a dumb thing. So what? You know, and I find a lot of survivors that I meet have that, a self-consciousness about it. And I fully understand where it comes from. You know, if they didn't have it themselves, their families and their caregivers are bound to give it to them because the rehabilitation, you know, they're trying to fix you, so obviously you got a problem. Well,
right.
But we do dumb things all the time. And, you know, a woman I've come to know who is an executive with a brain injury association, had a brain injury, and she's a very strong personality and so on. I was at a conference with her, and she said to me, she said, can you tell that I've got a brain injury? And I said to her, I'm going to have to think about that. And then about an hour later, I ran into her, and I said, no, I don't. I can't tell. It's just you. And she was so
good
relieved.
Answer. Good answer. That was a loaded question, like saying, honey, do I look fat in this? There's like no good answer for that, right? You had to stop and take
pause. Yeah, that was a lose-lose. I pulled that one out of the fire.
But, you sure did. Good answer on your feet, boy.
But it was true. It was absolutely true.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that a lot of times inappropriate behavior, it can become easy when you've been groomed, if you let yourself go unchecked as a survivor, to use your brain injury as an excuse for bad behavior instead of taking responsibility for saying, I know this is me and I've got some raw behavior. I need to work on that. That's something about me that is a shortcoming that I need to work on. I have a lot of strengths, but I need to focus on my strengths, but some of the things that are shortcomings aren't just about my brain injury. It's about my brain injury and whether I'm compelled to shine the apple, you know?
Yeah, but, I mean, aren't we, all of us, in pursuit of the better us?
Yes.
All of the time?
Well, we'd like to think so.
So in what way is a brain injury survivor any different from the rest of
them?
I mean, we're all trying to improve ourselves. And, yeah, we may have got shunted sideways by a truck or a car or, you know, or a tree falling or whatever. But we're all trying to improve ourselves. And, you know,
I'd like to think so. And there's probably as many people that get stuck in the brain injury community as out in, quote unquote, the real world, your abnormal, normal world. You know, there's people out there who haven't been through this experience that go through the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that Andrew did for me too, did for us during the early stages of recovery. I mean, here he is with 50% of his skull missing, which he did not get back for 7 months.
Wow.
And we go out in public, you know, and he's wearing a cervical collar and a black hat covering this, you know, missing part of his skull. And, you know, one of his eyes is a little off at that point. And we go to restaurants. We walk up from the rehabilitation hospital to a lovely bar that has a patio in summer, and we're sitting out there. And he is not self-conscious about this. He is deliberately not self-conscious. And his brother and I, we were self-conscious, but I said to myself, if he's not self-conscious, I have no reason to be self-conscious at all. You know, and at that time, I was sort of, you're sort of living with it. And so stuff that I now take a look at photographs we took in that patio at that time, mm-hmm. I get queasy mm-hmm. when I look at them because I've had enough distance between then and now. So at the time, I was accepting of what he looked like because that was just him. But I was also mindful of the fact that he was so different from other people that in appearance that could be an embarrassment to him and an embarrassment to me. So I think that, and I think you'll find this too, I think with him, that he's very much take me as I am. You know, he's very much trying to improve himself as in all sorts of ways. But he's also very much, I think, accepting of who he is, and he puts himself out there in the world. He's a performer. He DJs. He composes electronic
mm-hmm.
music. You know, his nickname
he's gonna
is Mental
let
Floss.
Us, yeah, Mental Floss. He's going to let us play some of his music next week. So I'm
good.
Looking forward to that. I know. We're both real excited about that. We had our initial conversation, but then when he told me about the music, I've been on my own quest to find you know, independent musicians who own the rights to their music who'd like to share it, you know, in after hours with, you know, the Brain Injury Radio Network. And I've been very fortunate and blessed to run into a lot of people who have been willing to do that. Plus, it's worldwide exposure, you know, for them. But interestingly, Andrew didn't seem to care about that much as he did to share. You know, there's just to share with other survivors. So I really appreciated his attitude, and he sent me permission to, sorry, there's a UFO flying over my house. For those of you that are picking up on that, I think E.T. just went overhead.
Your house than mine.
Yeah. Well, we live in the flight pattern of Stratcom, so I don't like to see them hanging that low.
No.
When they're coming over my back porch, I could almost touch that wheel. I'm sorry, folks from around the world. That was a little technical difficulty of my own around here. The boys are back. Anyway, we will be very excited to talk to Andrew next week. So the response to your book has generally been a positive one in the medical environments, and it sounds like you're going to get further with nursing and some of the people, medical practitioners who are really hands-on with these patients every day versus the doctors who seem to have a fine scientific skill of fixing something that's broken to the best of their ability, but they seem to be a little out of touch with the reality of a new reality for that patient. It sounds like it might be the therapists, the nurses, the more hands-on practitioners that are going to be able to accomplish this thing more effectively than the doctors with more empathy and understanding. At least that was my observation after, you know, looking through your book.
Yeah, my our experience with our doctors was very good, and you know, with almost all of them, there's an anecdote and story about one of them who wasn't one of those touchy feely people, but for the most part it is good. But you're correct in saying that it's the ones that have spending more time with the patients, so the important ones as far as the book is concerned, and the ones that see the value in it professionally. The book's also got some to-do lists in it for close family and for and a second set for the friends and colleagues, you know, that caregiving team that you build up around you as when you go into these crises, so that they don't have to start off blind, you know, and not knowing what to do. And one of the hospitals that Andrew was in most of the time, the second hospital out of the four that he was in, are at this process preparing to use the to-do lists and have them in the waiting room for neurotrauma ICU just to help people out. You know, it's kind of a tear-off pad so they can take it away. So the reception around the world has been good. It's on a bunch of online book sites. Amazon's got it, but there's been, you know, in Australia there are three, and in Croatia there is one, India,
wow.
You know, New Zealand and Sweden, and you know, sort of all over the place. So it's you know, it's finding its way. It's written in pretty plain English, so it's very accessible, and it's very helpful for families as well as to professionals. But you know, it's a hard story too.
Yeah, it seems to me it would really help the professionals and the caregivers to be able to communicate with each other, for one, and to better understand and, like you say, work as a team with your survivor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I walk nurses through an exercise, which is quite fascinating. But ultimately, it brings them to a point where they suddenly understand how poorly they might be communicating with the patient's family.
Yes.
You know, the patient's family, you know, is when they're in that initial briefing, they become catatonic. They only hear part of what's being said.
Right.
They remember not all of it. They don't remember some of the important details. And it's like somebody speaking a completely unintelligible language to you. And
my parents felt that way too. I mean, you always think it's going to happen to someone else or something, right? You're never expecting to just have one moment be a regular day and the next moment walk into the twilight zone clueless. I mean, what a horrible thing, you know, and those professionals are going through it every day, but I don't think they know, you know, for those of us that come in there in your shoes or in my shoes, that it's the first time and it's not a dress rehearsal. We're on stage and we didn't even get to see the script.
Yeah.
We don't even know what questions to ask. You know, at least you're giving us a basis of discussion, you know, that the caretaker can have with the professional who hopefully has the ear of the doctor then. But if not, that they're able to take it upon themselves to increase the level of communication at that level of recovery, because even that is going to be a big boost from the nothing that was offered before in helping to acclimate a survivor by stages into their new reality instead of it being such an abrupt, you know, from you're dead one minute to, oh, another Monday.
You know? Yeah.
That's confusing.
Only it's four months later than you last recall being
right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, and your bean has been cracked and sewn back together, you know, a couple of times by then. So, you know, you get your bell rung a little bit and your perceptions tend to change, you know, on both sides of it. But I'm really glad that you, how did you know about, did you just innately know or hear about, or did I miss that? Your blood technique, was that something you defined or it just came to you as a family out of desperation and shock? That's the way you reacted. Where did that come from, the concept?
Yeah, you know, I think it was instinctive, you know, in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And the term was something that just came to me out of the blue many months later when I was trying to summarize my thinking about what the reaction had been and how it had been. You know, because I go into the book my first bedside experience with Andrew,
mm-hmm.
Where I think I later came to realize that I had had an experience not only with this damaged body on the bed, but also with his persona that was strong and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
That was just adjacent to him. And so in a sense, and I had already accepted that effectively he was dead, and it was at that point that experience happened, which I can't explain. But it was at that point that I realized that communication hadn't taken place. And so it was, for me, that was what made it automatic that I would continue that communication in whatever form that it required. And, you know, Andrew's mother was right there doing these things as well, and his aunt, and, you know, massaging him and all those sorts of things. And it was just something that came naturally. And, you know, once one person started it, I think others began to say, okay, you know, the nurses are fine with it, so it's not dangerous to the patient. And it's an instinctively good thing to do. You want to do it, you know?
Right.
And so I think that's how it came about. But,
well, the synergy, it obviously worked. You know, if nothing else, I would think, and this isn't minimizing or invalidating at all, but you find yourself in a state of stark powerlessness.
Absolutely.
And it's a place you haven't been before because you've really never had control, but you've had the illusion of control, and suddenly the rug is jerked out from under you so hard, and you find out you are powerless. And so to sit there and stew in powerlessness versus a proactive action, sequence of action, like the synergy that came together with your family was such a productive way to work through your process, you know, of shock, unfamiliarity, and it was just coming and growing and it seems like it was taking on its own momentum.
Yeah, good way of putting it. It was. You know, and by somebody doing something that then gives permission to others to do things too. And it effectively challenges them, forces them out of their catatonic state into being active. And they feel better. As soon as they start doing something, you feel better. I mean, this is one of the wonderful lessons about doing good for others. Yeah, it helps them. But you feel so good in the process.
Right. One of the sayings I live by is you've got to give it away to keep it. So, you know, every time you're of service to your fellows without expectation, it seems to be the nature of the universe that it does come back to you, but not necessarily always directly or in the way that you would have envisioned it. But it does, like, come out in the wash, as they say, you know, over a period of time. If you're open to the miracles happening and just willing to be open-minded, that now that this shift has happened in your life, you've got to be open to a lot of other things that, you know, they weren't issues on the table before. And now they're a priority. So that, I just think that's really cool that you had the kind of experience you had. I'm sorry you had to have the experience, obviously, but there's purpose, you know, in you and Andrew's story, and it was good of you to share that as a cathartic exercise for you, as a, whether he sees it as that or not, as an act of love toward Andrew as a parent, but also to help all those people coming behind who didn't get the manual, you know? Now there's a real good chance they might be able to get their hands on a manual, find something that's going to help them find strength in their powerlessness and help fortify their faith, you know, if they have one, because at that moment they might be tempted to lose it at the time they need it the most.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's kind of a spiritual experience in some ways, because that's really what you're working on. You know, to me, when someone's in a coma, as I was, you know, you're in between. And so there's work being done on the other side. It's good for the balance. There's work being done on this side beyond just the technical of a surgical procedure, but also that soul connection, that soul work, because soul work is going on the backside. So for it to continue to go on in the front side, I think that's really good too, to introduce that balance from early on through the process of recovery and after, as you talk about.
Yeah, and I have heard from other families, both survivors of various conditions and their caregivers, stories of the families actually reaching into comas and the survivor remembering the contact. And that's really interesting to hear that.
It is. Ian, we're going to continue to talk for just a moment, but I just wanted to let anyone know who has a question or comment for Ian. Feel free to call in now. We've got about 15 minutes left in the show. The number is 424-243-9540. Some of us will roll into overtime, but it's nice Ian's been able to spend this time with him, so I'll let him off the hook in just a couple minutes, but I do want to, we do want to take your calls and any comments that you might have. Also, if you think you want to stay around for overtime where we just do some general chat, play some music, then you need to dial in. The live show will fall off the air. So whether you've got a question or comment or you just want to stay on for overtime, dial 424-243-9540. And if you have a question, press 1, and I'll see it and bring you on the line. And otherwise, I'll just let you listen and we'll finish up with Ian and thank him for sharing his story. Again, we want to thank our sponsor, Gordon Johnson of TBILaw.com. Check him out. And we do have a question.
Yeah, and if there are other questions after the show, too, that people want to send my way, they can either do it through you or they can go to the website and contact me that way as well.
And tell us the website again. It's in the program notes, and I'll put it in the chat room in just a minute, or one of you can. But go ahead and say it on the air for us and give me the name of your book again in the right sequence.
Okay. The website is www.maret.cc, and Maret is spelled MARRETTE.cc. And then once you're there, you can get to the particular part of the book publishing site. But that you can also go to by doing maret.cc/hcpro.html.
HTML. So www.maret.cc/acpro.html.
Yeah, it's hcpro.html.
Got
healthcare
it.
Healthcare Pro, yeah.
Oh, got it. Okay, I'm going to change
it's
that.
It's a forward slash. So
oh, right.
CC,
I always get
slash.
My forwards and backwards. You can see now I've turned around the name of your show, turned around your name and your website. I'm now I'm one of our brain-injured hosts. I apologize.
You're overcorrecting.
Yeah, I am. I'm overcorrecting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Obviously.
And so the book is From Grave to Cradle to Now.
Okay. And I'm typing that in, too. That, by the way, people, writing helps you remember, if you remember, From Grave to Cradle to Now by Ian Powell. Okay, great. Frank from New York, we have you on the line with Ian. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I have a question and a comment. Now, Ian, you were talking a bit about neuroplasticity, and I kind of either wasn't paying attention when the word came up, but would you go into some more explanation about what exactly neuroplasticity is? I think I know about that because I've met a guru. His name is John Assaraf. He was in the movie The Secret. And he talks a lot about what the brain is capable of doing. Would you want to expand on that?
Yeah, again, I'm not a professional in this regard, but for many years, for decades, for hundreds and hundreds of years, the assumption was that the brain basically was hardwired.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1960s, I believe, some scientists began to think that maybe that was not the case. They had seen some examples of people that had been injured and had miraculous recoveries, and so they thought there had to be a practical explanation for this. And so a lot of research was done, and it's only been in the past 15 years that people, scientists, have come to accept that the brain, in fact, continually changes, and that
mm-hmm.
we can make it change, like education, training, can make a change. Learning to play a sport can change. A rough rule of thumb is it takes about 10,000 hours of things to learn a sport or, another language or something of that kind that brings about those changes. But it is, in fact, the brain does do rewiring of itself, and I don't want to get any more technical than that. There is a book that has some stories of this happening, stories of what is called personal triumphs from the frontiers of brain science. And it's a book called The Brain That Changes Itself. And it's a Penguin book. And the doctor that put together this collection and edited it. His name is Norman Doidge, D-O-I-D-G-E. And there was a PBS show, which you may be able to get online as a podcast of some kind, as well on that, which is actually quite amazing. And that will help explain it to the level of detail that you know, that you might want.
Great. Frank, did you also have a comment? Was that your,
your
question?
Yes, I wanted to talk about his son. His son's name is Andrew, right?
Right.
Yep, he's going to be on next week.
Thank God you got him. This is great. Thank you, Kim. Now, Andrew, he doesn't seem, you said that he doesn't seem to be aware of his disability, does he? And that when you were looking at the pictures, that you were kind of upset with how you had judged him or something. I can't remember exactly what. But that is a common practice for people who have a TBI. I just wanted to tell you that people like myself, like Kim, like Les Paul, everybody I've met, they aren't aware of I can't really say this right, but what their disability is, and that they kind of get over the fact that they have a disability. And it's the people who are around them that are reacting to the fact they might have a voice problem, or they might have a helmet on their head or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to say it. I don't want you to feel badly about how you react to people to your son's disability, because that I find to be very common in the disability community.
I like your comments, because there are occasions when I think that he reacts to us, that is his family, particularly to me as father. You know, there's still some of those sort of latent father-son things. And he may react more strongly than he thinks he's reacting.
Hmm.
And of course, I react, you know, as I would normally, but I've learned to adjust to not take it as it appears, but to take it as he probably intended it to be.
Right. Okay, great. We had just one more call, and we've got about 7 minutes. So this is Les Paul. You're on the air with Ian.
Hi, Ian. It's wonderful hearing you. I'm going to try to make this short because I know there's not a lot of time. But I couldn't help but think about something that I've talked about on here myself many times, which is music therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to meet many music therapists, and the multiple techniques they try, and not try, they succeed very much in getting people to speak and find themselves when they're lost in themselves. I was lost in myself. I came out of a coma to the Beatles song yesterday. I've said that a million times on here. So I don't know if you've heard it, but I have seen people responding to whether it's a metronome, a guitar, a harmonica, or someone playing bongos around them, or the brain has a rhythm that is a deep within us that we don't even realize is there. It's like your heartbeat. You don't pay attention to your heartbeat, mm-hmm. but it's beating all the time. And we have a body clock that is a rhythm. And the brain goes on that like a metronome. And I highly recommend that you just check out that. And I listed the movie The Music Never Stopped, which came out about a year and a half ago, and it's about a person who they thought was so lost in himself. So I'll stop there, but nice to meet you.
Thank you, Les.
Okay.
You've got a great musical name.
Yes, he does.
Yes,
yes he does.
Now,
I've got a couple of those cuts in my studio.
One of the things that Andrew did, I mean, Andrew has been a musician, an electronic musician. He plays a number of musical instruments, but he's an electronic musician and composer, and he's got a global reputation and has had since he was in his mid-teens. In his coma, I was there one day sitting with his hand, holding his hand, and he started tapping out a rhythm on my hand, and he was in the coma. And when he stopped, I tapped the rhythm back on his hand. And then he tapped it again and then extended it.
Wow.
And we did a couple of those. And then he stopped. And yes, music is powerful in reaching into people. And so getting copies of their favorite songs and playing them, you know, to them while they're in the coma is tremendously helpful, and certainly is great therapy at any time.
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about. Like I say, Andrew and I had a nice talk about that, and I'm looking forward to playing some of his music next week and hearing about his journey. A lot of us have found that if we weren't necessarily into it before, that within our recovery we go through a stage of creativity and an artistic bent that may not have been there, or at least not exhibited in the same way as it wound up being in our recovery. So it never surprises me now when I hear of somebody writing a book or being a music, you know, composer, lyricist, or a painter or photographer, or whatever it might be, that people have gone through these creative stages when faced with their mortality. But in any case, Ian, I want to thank you so very much for being with us tonight, sharing your time and your story. I encourage you guys to look him up, read more about the story. If you have any further questions for Ian, you can write to me at my site, inaflash.org. There's a tab up top that says Contact the Author. That sends an email directly to me, and I'll be happy to address your question or forward it to Ian. Ian, again, thank you so much for being our guest tonight. We appreciate you sharing, and we'll really look forward to talking to Andrew next week, and we want to thank you for coming tonight.
Well, thank you very much, Kim. It's been a great pleasure, and I want to encourage all of your listeners to just get out there and be yourselves.
Thanks. That's a great note to close on. You have a good night now.
Thank you. You too. And your listeners. Mm-hmm.
Bye. Bye-bye. Well, everybody, that was Ian Powell McCullum. So I encourage you to check out his book, From Grave to Cradle and Back. And we put the website in there a couple times. I'll put it in again. I want to remind you, I will be rolling into overtime where we can have further discussion as you see fit, or just play a little music for a while. The number is 424-243-9540. If you don't call in, you'll be dropped off the live line. And we want to remind you that the overtime is recorded, as is the rest of the show, so it's available immediately after the live show in the on-demand section. We encourage you to listen to the programs at your leisure and all the time, of course, and listen to each of our 10 hosts, and hope you enjoyed the program tonight. We always welcome your suggestions and comments about things you'd like to hear about on shows. So you can certainly write to any of your Blog Talk Radio hosts, or check us out on Facebook at Brain Injury Radio. Now I'm going to close in my usual way with something I believe we all have, and that is a guardian angel. This is by Leah West. Check out her website, Leah, L-E-A-H, West.com. She's a cutie. And we'll see you on the other side of the hour. And if not, thank you so much for being here, and hope we'll see you next week.
God replies, yes, it's your time to leave. But don't you worry, you won't be there alone. You're still
stop me at the teapot, but that should effectively start our overtime right now. I'd like to remind you that the overtime is recorded and part of the on-demand show, so keep that in mind. We love to have your questions, comments, and ideas about other shows and things that you'd be interested in, but at this point, I'm going to unmute Les Paul and Frank and Keith Anthony. And anyone else who's out there who wants to call in, feel free to do that. So how'd you guys like Ian? He's a real good guest.
He was great.
He was really great.
Yeah, he sounds like a really well-informed man, and I think that's cool that they write kind of a caregiver for dummies manual. In an affectionate way, I mean that. But, you know, instead of being very high technical speak, it's something that, you know, a nurse or, you know, a therapist or somebody like that could sit down and read in layman's terms on a feeling level about something, and it might be easier to take in, you know, than picking up a technical textbook, you know what I mean? Because it has about relatability with other people. So I think that's really cool. I mean, there's probably a lot of people doing it, but I have never met one.
Well, I'll say it like this. What you just said is when they were talking about a lot of my medical records, they were showing them in front of me in the doctor's office one time, and I said, I hate to interrupt you, but I didn't understand about 80% of what you just said. I'm not trying to call myself a dummy, but say it in layman's terms where it will be understandable. And he looked at me, and he acted like he didn't know how to.
Yeah.
And then he thought about it, and he sat down and said, okay, I'll explain it like this. And he simplified it, and it made it so much better because he was talking all this technical mumbo-jumbo that a lot of people don't understand because we don't live their lives and live in their realm. And I wish more often they would do that.
Oh, exactly. You know, DJ is always talking about getting your medical records, and I agree with that. But, like, if I go to read my medical records, I don't know a lot about what a lot of that means, you know. It would be nice if they, take the time to, it's kind of like legalese in a contract. You know, medical records are like medical ease in a contract. You know, it's kind of like all the compliance crap that's out in about every industry you can shake a stick at now. It's so much small print, it would give you a headache or a seizure to read it, so you just sign the dang stuff, you know. The compliance stuff is all over the place. It's taking over the world. Compliance.
Well, I'll use something as an example of what you're talking about. I received a paper a legal settlement in the mail a couple of days ago, and I'm saying, what is this about? I don't even remember this. And it was a company that had sued a company that something I had bought. I don't even remember what it was right now. And I got, man, you guys are going to be shocked how rich I am. Don't come hunting for me, because it was a whopping $16.99, if I'm not mistaken. And they said thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people were awarded that check in different levels, and the ones who really won were the attorneys, and it was in so much legal mumbo-jumbo, I looked at it, and it's like, wow, I can't understand most of this. I really didn't understand what the case was about, and that's why I appreciated how he put it down in very much layman's terms.
Yeah, I did too, and I think it was, you know, that certain things don't happen by mistake, and, you know, he could have been, like, I've never asked my parents, you know, a lot of the questions that, you know, he was addressing when talking about his side of things. You know, I lived my side. I didn't really live their side. And so it was interesting, the thought processes and everything, just getting to hear it from the other side. And then I had asked him about his son, and like he said, they've had their differences like any family relationship can have. I offered to have them be on the show together, but I think it works out better that we're going to do it separately, and that it'll be kind of a cool thing to hear from his dad this week and then him next week, and just the difference, you know, between the caregiver side of things and the survivor slash thriver, as Kevin would say, because Ian, or Andrew, really does seem cool. He was very hip, and he's gone through the music, which, you know, I'll be playing some of that, and gone down a few different roads in finding his new comfort level.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah, should be. Keith Anthony, I'm sorry you're feeling poorly tonight.
Are you there, Keith?
Yeah, I just had to unmute my microphone so I could talk with you.
Oh, I do that too. I forget when I go in to get my tea. I turn off my, I mute my mic, and then I have half a conversation with you guys, and you have no idea I'm here.
I knew it was worth it. It was just a matter of finding the window to unmute it.
Ah, okay. Well, I said I'm sorry that you were feeling poorly tonight.
Very much. That's a fabulous guest you have there. I was saying in the chat box, some people have names that are just going to make them successful, don't they? My name, Keith Taylor, and Ian, what was his name? Ian McCallum, wasn't it?
Powell McCallum.
Ian Powell McCallum. That's a name that's got to be at the top of your resume, isn't it? It's going to get you everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. It seems to be commanding attention, at least in medical, you know, in some traditional medical fields, and seems to be having success at spreading the word. He you know, named a few different countries as well as, you know, more local, national hospitals.
I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the show. In fact, I missed the first hour of the show, so I'm not too sure what it was about, but from the little he did say, I think I got up to speed very quickly. He was using massage on his son, am I guessing, when he was completely unresponsive?
Yeah, massage, kissing, touching, talking, maybe playing a familiar song, just instead of helping him figure out how to die, I think they were having a synergistic family gathering of how to keep him here.
I wish I'd had that, because when I was in my coma and coming out of the coma, I was locked in. I was felt like like you're encased in a layer of mud that had hardened, and you don't know how to get out. And my mind was how can I say it? I had awareness, but it was empty. I couldn't find points of reference to sort of find the door. I think I've said this on my shows, haven't I? And if somebody was to have done some massage on me, that would have helped me so much, because the skin is the largest organ we have, and it's got so many points of so many sensory points all over it that would help to develop your awareness to as it obviously has with his son, to help him find his way out. Marvelous.
Yeah, I agree. And even from more basic things, like, I don't know, you know, they talk about the laying there sedentary and bed sores and all the hazards of laying there. It seems like, you know, and then you have to put on those compression things on your legs now that drive everybody crazy. Mm-hmm. If you were getting massage, it would be helping your chi, you know, flow clearly without blockage and get your circulation going. Yes. So you'd think you'd be mitigating some of those annoyance problems.
The annoyance is the word I was about to use, because when you're like that, you're not cared for by the medical people. You're an annoyance. It would be better for them if you died, as I think one of you was saying earlier on. And they don't want to do anything with you except let you lay there. But, you know, they've only got to, I think nurses and doctors these days probably do turn you over occasionally, but not often enough. You'd probably get turned over once a day or something, wouldn't you? That's no good at all.
Yeah, I know my dad, when he was just in for that surgery, you know, couldn't be comfortable in any one position for any length of time because of the pain, and he needed to be moved frequently, but he had to try to find the button in the middle of his fog, or that's why I was there so much, because you could tell. You know, it was like the family was the one doing it. The nurses only came in about every sixth time. I was doing it every 15 minutes.
Yes. And I see, when I'm in the hospital, I see lots of particularly older patients who are uncomfortable. I can see they're uncomfortable. I'm not allowed to touch them, of course. I can see they're uncomfortable. They're sort of wriggling and what have you. If they were to be given a massage, I think that would help their level of comfort immensely. But, of course, they don't get that kind of thing because we call them places of where you have caregivers, but there are no caregivers in reality. There are people who are going through the motions of looking after people instead of actually looking after people, if I make myself plain there. I'm not sure I do.
Yeah, you do. I hope that it's shifting more than that. There's got to be some genuine compassion in people who are happy to be successful in their job, and it depends on how they want to measure success. If they're just doing the minimum of what's required, then I don't know how they could feel real good about themselves.
Yeah.
You know, if they're taking that extra step of being a human being who has a profession and, you know, relates to the person on a human level, but that's if you even get the opportunity. You know, if
yes.
you ever even get that opportunity, you
yeah.
might not to get any of those therapies or anything like that. If you look normal and talk, you know, normal or whatever, they just cut you loose. So you might not even ever get exposed. I got all these different records now, you know, 17 years till I met a survivor. Another, how long has it been till Dad's surgery and those tests that they were giving him and stuff, and how different it would have been 17 years before if I had any of those therapies he was getting
mm-hmm.
and back a back surgery. You know, how much
yeah.
time and trouble that would have saved me, A, thinking I was nuts, and B, giving me some tools that would have been helpful. I'm assuming
yes.
that all those memory tests and stuff that they were going through weren't just for the exercise of it. I would hope that they had, you know, some tools that would help you with whatever those deficits were, and that would be the basis for the testing in the first place, I hope, and not just a measurement of where someone's changed. You know, that would be like stopping short of a good goal, as far
yeah.
as I'm concerned. But, but I'm hoping things like his book will help, you know, the more it helps. Just like with Blog Talk Radio or, you know, Brain Injury Radio, it's like each time, you know, we're able to put information out there and one person tells another who tells another, you know, who tells another, and we grow slowly over time. I was thinking of, you know, Craig and, you know, giving him grief because he's, you know, his listenership is so great, and I thought, you know, he's the one that's done the time for 3 years, you know, showing up, suiting up, and getting that audience a little at a time. I guarantee you the
mm-hmm.
first 6 months he was on the radio, he didn't have the kind of following that he has now. He earned that with sweat, you know.
Yes.
And time served, and so rightly so, you know, and the rest of us are just trying to do, you know, do our best as we can. But, you know, it is a good thing that he started that movement and is getting, you know, each time he put a new host on or we get new guests, regular guests that come in and
mm-hmm.
and one person is telling another, then we're helping to spread the word, and a lot of people won't have to go through some of the same stuff we did. You know, they won't have to be operated in a MASH unit like you know, like Les Paul, and they won't have to go 35 years and almost be have a lobotomy, you know, like you, Keith Anthony. Luckily, I'm hoping that things are just be pitched a shutout like I was
yeah.
17 years
yeah.
ago. You know, I think, you know, the more that word gets around, the more people are at least going to have an awareness where there was never an awareness before.
Right.
And you hope that awareness will lead to change.
Yes, I'm not sure I don't think I ever recovered from that lobotomy.
That's because you didn't have one.
Oh, it was a joke, you know, Kim, a joke.
Uh-huh,
we did
I got
that
it. Yes.
Well, something you were talking about a few minutes ago was a, you were talking about having to be turned into bed every 15 minutes or so.
Yeah.
I have several friends who are spinal cord injury survivors, and I don't know if everybody knows this, but people who are spinal cord injury survivors that have no range of motion at all, they have to be turned every so often, or they'll get sores, bed sores, that could be fatal. And I was just thinking about that when you were talking about that. And it applies to people with brain injuries who are comatose or whatever, because laying on your bottom or laying in one place for too long, fluid will build up on the lungs, all kinds of different things. And knowing the people I know with the spinal cord injuries, I mean, I've been at my friend's house when she'll be talking to me. She'll say, "Excuse me, Les," and someone will come in and turn her. And she has some excellent caregivers. Some of them are friends, and some of them are people that are hired. And we need to find out what the best way is to find that kind of a caregiver, to find the right one, because it's hard.
Well, yeah, and some people would maybe not feel comfortable, I'm sure, you know, touching the patients in that way, you know, probably has some kind of litigation consequence if, you know, the person, like say the person, because they've been rattled a little, that, you know, we don't know what their history has been, that might be something that would be invasive to them or intimidating to them. It's hard to know. It wouldn't be for me. I think that healing touch, it's very legitimate. That's been the most helpful thing for me with my ongoing pain condition, is having, you know, cranial work and massage. And I think that all helps, you know, because it gets the blood going. And
Yes. The touch is very important. And I became aware of that yesterday evening in the hospital where I worked voluntarily with hospital radio, and I go and visit the patients. And I met a lady there who was a lovely lady. I don't know how old she was. She might have been maybe 35, 40, maybe a bit older, I'm not sure. She's a very nice lady. And she'd come in that day. She'd had surgery, and she came in, you know, like you do, you're coming into hospital, you don't know what to expect. She'd come in that morning. That morning, they rushed her into surgery and gave her a mastectomy that she wasn't expecting.
Oh.
And then in the evening, you know, less than 24 hours later, I'm talking with her in the ward, and she's happy and smiley and being positive about it, and I talk with her. And she'd overheard me talking to another patient about, you know, what I've been through, because I do that in the hospital, to give them strength and give them courage. And we talked for a long time, and my colleague was trying to drag me away, because they don't like you to spend time with people. It's foreign to them, you know, but I spend a lot of time with people rather than just getting their record requests. And when I left her finally, though, and she was a Christian woman, so we had some Christian words, and I don't mind doing that. And when I left her, the last thing she did, and I find a lot of patients like to do this with me, and I'm not supposed to do it because we're not allowed to touch the patients. But she held out her hand, and we held hands for a bit and smiled at each other. And when I do that, I try to channel energy through that hand, and I can see that it works because their whole demeanor perks up. You know, I'm actually leaving, and they perk up when I touch their hand, you know, and sort of shake hands or whatever it is. Touch is so important, but nobody in hospital gets it. And probably, I remember when I was a child, I never had any touch from anybody, and probably not until I was maybe 25 or something like that. And I was lacking in my social build-up because of that. But and it's okay because I'm used to it. But some people really do need that touch more than others. Am I talking too much?
No, I think that's true. I mean, I concur completely. It's funny they don't, you know, that they don't do that, and that things like that would have to come up, of the appropriateness or whatever, because I really do think that it's like you said. I envision it like you say when I was talking about that friend of mine that passed earlier and how me and another girl were, you know, rubbing oil and talking gently to her and this and that. We knew she was going to die. She was terminal, you know. She was on the end of the line, but we were just helping her, that touch. I think if you're making the transition and you can have the support and comfort on the front end that you're getting on the other end, that's pretty cool. You know, again, I say synergistic because it just helps, like, transfer the spirit from one side to the other. If the person's going to die, you know, like what he was talking about, if they're going to get well, I think their spirit is just going to respond to the touch here, you know, in the human realm, and respond to it in a positive way and want to come back to that, be drawn back to life through that energy you were talking about.
Yes.
I'm thankful that you do that, Keith. You're probably helping a lot more people than you realize just by visiting. Because when I was in the hospital when I had the brain aneurysm, my mother said I had a very lonely, lost look on my face when I came out of it and didn't know where I was at and didn't recognize most of the people around me outside of my mother. I didn't even recognize my brothers. But I couldn't remember my mother some of the time. She said, but when she would put her hands on me and tell me she loved me, I would smile and I didn't even know who she was. And I would say, I would try to say that she said she could sort of understand me, but it was really a bunch of broken words that it appeared that I was trying to say thank you. And that's all she could say because I couldn't really speak English. It was just a bunch of gibberish and some words would come out mixed into it.
Yes.
And I was laying there basically almost hallucinating because I was seeing all kinds of things, not knowing what was real and what wasn't. And you're very lonely and desolate when you're that.
Yes. So, you've just taken me back 35 years saying that, Les Paul, when you're talking about not knowing what was real and what isn't.
No.
I can't even say it, not knowing what is and what isn't real.
Yeah.
I went through that, and I'm sure that many of us do that. And that's why I was talking about earlier on needing points of reference, and the skin being the largest organ is such a rich source of those points of reference, and so is music, because music is so infinite. There's got to be something in there somewhere that if it's just a single note that you can latch onto and you can focus on that note, and then you can build up a picture around it, which is what I did when I was coming out of coma, because But the thing I felt most when I was locked in was, you imagine being put into a cell and solitary confinement on your own. You've got four walls, a ceiling, and a floor, and that would be bad enough, wouldn't it? But I was feeling isolated completely, and I had no walls, I had no ceiling, I had no floor. I had nothing. It was just total sensory cutoff deprivation. And if somebody was to only touch me in a nice way, because I was aware of pain in my feet. I didn't know what it was, but it was really painful. It happened regularly. And that was because a doctor was scraping the soles of my feet with a sharp spike. No, I mean sharp. To see if he would get any reaction.
Trying to see if your nerves would feel
and
it. Yeah.
So for the longest time, I had no awareness at all.
I was told that same thing was done to me. It's amazing the similarities between so many of us on this.
And it's so painful. The doctors, they don't have any concept that we are human beings still and that we feel pain when they do these things to us. And I think it's very important, and I see them in the hospital now doing procedures on people, and you know the people are quite often unconscious, and they don't talk to the people. They don't say, "Mr. Taylor, this is the doctor here, and we're just going to give you an injection. Just relax," anything like that. They just walk up to the bed, get their tray out, get the needle up, you know, and just stick it in. They've got no respect. They've got no concept of what's the dignity of the patient. I don't believe.
That's really up for grabs. Dignity and patience don't quite go together. It doesn't seem like, at least not from that experience.
For,
I just,
isn't it?
Yeah, you're pretty exposed there. So,
yes, they need to treat people with respect, but they don't. I don't think. I'm sure it's not intentional. It's ignorance.
Well, yeah, they're just getting their job done the fastest possible route, and that doesn't always include dignity, you know. Which,
sadly,
that,
I think we feel like a slab of meat on a table when they're doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't realize it.
Yeah.
That language is so important. I'm sorry to cut you off, Kim. I do apologize. Can I carry on, or shall I let you talk?
Please, carry on.
The medical people really don't appreciate the value of language and the damage it can do, because, you know, you imagine a patient is laying there, he or she can't go anywhere, and they wet the bed. And they will be aware that they've wet the bed, and that's going to be humiliating to them, but perhaps they can't communicate in the way they would like to. And how do you communicate about wetting your bed? But then the medical people come along and they'll say something, oh, look, you've wet your bed again. Oh, dear. But they need to treat it in a positive way. If that was me going up to the bed, I would say, well, we're going to make you more comfortable because, unfortunately, you wet the bed, but don't worry about it because we're going to clean you up, and that's perfectly okay. That would be my approach, but you don't get the kind of approach. So you get told off. You know, somebody who can't respond being told off for wetting the bed is not going to be a very positive experience for them, is it?
Well, even most recently with a family member, he didn't get told off for it, but now they stick these waterproof pads underneath people, and they basically just come in, don't say anything, treat you like that piece of meat, tell you to flip over while they change the thing off. In the meantime, the covers are off and the gown is splayed open, and that's humiliating enough without getting bitched at for it. Excuse me. But yeah, that's pretty rough. But so Frank, are you just coasting over there? Yeah. Okay. I thought it was kind of funny that I hadn't run across the name Ian. Just for Ian's sake, I hadn't run into an Ian in like 100 years, and then I was prospecting for guests, and within 2 weeks I had 2 Ians, which really cracked me up, you know. Ian Powell McCallum tonight, but I played this the other night. I'm going to see if it'll play again tonight while I mute my mic and hopefully not forget to unmute it while I run and get my tea. But for 3 minutes and 51 seconds, my guest 2 weeks ago, who was very interesting, had a lot to do with the Brain Alliance and the TBI Association in Montana. Ian Elliott also happens to write music, and I didn't remember when I played last week. I knew I needed to credit the guy who sings it, but I didn't have his name with me, but it's Steven Zediker is the singer, but Ian Elliott did write the lyrics and the music, so we'll take 3 minutes and 51 seconds to hear Peaceful River, I hope, and then we'll be back for more discussion.
Quiet river, God's gentle voice divine. Trusting in you, I go forward, leaving all doubt far behind. quiet river flowing through heart and mind.